Welcome to Beyond the Scope, a podcast where we explore the intricacies of healthcare through conversations with the pioneers in health. What's going on, where it's heading, and how it affects us all. This is Jerry, and together with my fellow hosts, Krish and Nishanth, we hope this inspires and challenges you to join in on the conversation.
Jerry, I want you to share your experience as being a houseman in the private sector and the public sector in South Africa. Those stories that you shared with me, they have been etched in my head.
Yeah, there's a lot of stories there. There's a lot of stories. And if you speak to a lot of young doctors who are my age, they'll tell you an equal amount of crazy stories that they've heard. And also what Chris was saying, the dichotomy between like private and public in terms of the patients that you see and the experience that you have is starkly different. It's so different, and it's quite amazing to see that that actually exists in one country, for example, South Africa. So I'll give you an example, right? Like, I mean, one of the days, and this has happened a few times, I arrived to work because I was working mostly in casualty as an emergency doctor in a rural hospital called Christ the King District Hospital in Ikopo, South Africa. And I get called by one of the nurses, and she brings me to this room where I'm supposed to certify death of a patient. And then I walk in, and there I see a young man stabbed in his chest, a big hole in his chest, and his skull literally having like a flap from a machete injury. So he had been obviously assaulted. And that was how my morning started. It started with that, to go and certify a death. His body was brought in by family.
This is one of those things I still am not able to comprehend, like how doctors are able to see such things, yeah, and still be able to go about doing their day-to-days, normally. It's just unreal for me. But yeah. Go on.
Yeah, I know. Like,
did you get desensitized after a while, Jerry?
You know, I'm going to be honest and tell you that there is a huge element of desensitization, and it's not something I think doctors who do feel desensitized are necessarily proud of. And I would also say, like, I don't think that desensitization is necessarily linked to lack of empathy, also, because you can still be empathetic. Mm. But have a degree of separation that protects your emotions. And I think because we've gone through a medical system, also a medical training, and we've seen a lot of this from our early years in medical school, seeing it at that stage and having seen thousands of patients already, it wasn't surprising in some sense. It was just sad, rather, to have to continually accept that this is happening in the healthcare system. So, yeah, I think that's one thing I'd say about that.
So what's the juxtaposition? Like, what was it like in the private sector?
So in the private sector, the disease burden is completely different. I mean, you don't see as many assault injuries of that nature in private. In private, you see kind of like textbook medical conditions like heart attacks, strokes, tummy aches, fractures. But you don't see the amount of road traffic accidents that you would see in public health, as in the public health sector, mm, or like, drunk related violence or, abuse, or infectious diseases is a huge one, right? You don't see a lot of HIV and tuberculosis in private, whereas in public, you see a lot of infectious diseases, because unfortunately, as we know, infectious diseases is relegated to a population of people who don't have, access to basic amenities, education, good education, good healthcare, health literacy, all problems that are historically embedded, especially for South Africa, with apartheid and all of that, and the separation of people.
Yep.
But yeah. I mean, we could speak on that forever. And
it'd be interesting though. Like, is this data between public, private healthcare available online?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, people have done lots of social science research on this, as well as quantitative research on this, to show the discrepancy between public and private, to show how infectious disease burdens are a lot higher in, you know, the public health sector, to show the inequitable distribution of healthcare between different population groups. I mean, there's a lot of research on this, and I think one of the tasks of this podcast is to tell or display to the listeners like this huge discrepancy, and how these people that we're interviewing are trying to patch these discrepancies, right? They're trying to sort of build a bridge, and just sort of equilibrate everything.
So because of this, that would mean the expertise of doctors in the private sector would be very different from the expertise of doctors who work in the public sector, right? There's some dynamics over there, isn't it? But also, private sector is more prestigious also, I would assume.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess like private's also a place where there's a lot of money, right? So in South Africa, right, the private sector takes up more than 3/4 of public health spending. Healthcare spending. Whereas it only serves like, you know, less than 1/4 of the population. So there's a huge difference in how. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But in terms of the expertise, so you're right. So you're obviously seeing very different types of diseases, right, as a doctor working in private and public. And so if you're just siloed in one of those areas, then you're only going to see patients of that who come in with that sort of disease burden in that particular area. But there are a lot of doctors who also do crossover work, right? So they do public as well as private. So they're kind of like straddling the two worlds, and so they got fairly good expertise, but definitely the academic and research expertise is 100% in like the public sector in South Africa at least. But I must add here, and this is where Christian and Shant, like what you guys are doing is incredibly important, more so than ever now, as we realize how technology is really technology and innovation is really, you know, kind of bringing the solutions to this COVID fight. One of the big areas of public health is data science. It's how do you utilize data for effective public health intervention and change, right? Everyone's all connected nowadays with like technology. I think even in South Africa, by the way, like cell phone penetrance, for example, is the highest it's ever been. So nearly every single person has like a cell phone, and so there's a lot of like mHealth, mobile health technology innovation that's happening in South Africa and other parts of Africa, and it's really cool how it's helping people access healthcare. So I just want to actually ask Nishant this, because he had mentioned that I know you're a problem solver. Can you just give us a quick lowdown on how you look at problems, because you've got a very particular way of structuring your sort of problem-solving attempts.
As an engineer, you're kind of trained to break things apart and then put them back together. And if you look at anything as a system, so healthcare as a system, first you want to understand what the pieces are and how they play together and how they connect together. And you can go all the way down from healthcare system as a whole, the big players, and then you can start talking about doctors, clinics, what kind of systems work together over there. And then ultimately, in our case, we were trying to figure out how to make the data usable. Basically, there are a lot of frameworks around this, right? You go ask a lot of whys. You figure out why is it that data is not being shared, what is the incentive to share the data, and then who is the person who benefits from the data, how much are they willing to, like, what benefits do they get from the data, and there are obviously regulations around this for good reason. You have to understand why the regulations came up, what direction they are heading in. You have to understand what the doctors are incentivized to do. In some cases, they are incentivized by desire to, you know, just help people. Sometimes they're incentivized because, you know, it's one of the most lucrative professions and they, you know, kind of studied so that they could make lots of money. I've seen that as well. And the way they behave is different in each case. And so if you put all of this together, the doctor, the nurse, the clinic, the hospital, the pharmaceuticals, they kind of connect and play together in different ways.
Yeah.
But to actually go into a specific facet of the system and try to make a change, in our case, we are working primarily with, say, primary care clinics. From that angle, once you have all the pieces, then you can figure out how to put the pieces back together into a different configuration. But you can't change the basic incentives. The doctor who's there to make lots of money will always make choices that help them make more money. The doctor who's there to help more people will make choices that helps them.
Is this your experience from trying to implement and introduce Clinify? The structure and the doctor itself, these are all sort of the feedback and reflections you've gotten through your attempt to your journey with Clinify.
Yes, definitely. We were exploring multiple markets as well, so that we were able to understand the differences between places like Singapore, Malaysia, Japan, India, how doctors think in these different, and obviously it's not all the same.
Sri Lanka, Australia
as well. And you can see the spectrum, how it differs, what kind of doctors you can see by area, and then you can see correlations between how a clinic is run versus the doctor who's running the clinic and what they are trying to do. You can see how, say, large clinical groups expand across countries, on what basis do they start a new clinic. And it all feeds together when you figure out how to make a change, because ultimately the incentives have to be aligned.
And we are able to get the insights from the anonymous data, right? Our business premise was we go in, we give a great solution for primary care providers to be able to manage their practice end to end. We give it at a nominal fee, and we make it very clear to the doctors that we are analyzing and commercializing the anonymous insights. And so the doctors, you know, sign against the data clause. It's not like hidden in some essay, some privacy and data essay that, you know, other companies do. So we were very upfront, and that allowed us to basically now, you know, we're seeing over like 1,400 doctors worth of data. And it's interesting insights that we're seeing. And so we're able to see the relationship between the providers, I mean, the insurance providers, the third-party administrators, the doctors across region, the kind of influence pharma has. And like what Nishant said, like once you realize that you figure out the blocks for each of within one sector in the healthcare industry, then you put it back together and you can figure out how to make a difference. The challenge though is actually like how long it takes to figure this out, and being able to survive as a business to get there. We got lucky in many ways, this brings me to the next point, which is you shared about chronic illness, being the burden in the private sector. And one of the things I'm really passionate about, even after seeing the data in developing country like Malaysia, chronic illness is the top disease burden on the healthcare industry, on the healthcare spend.
Yeah.
And where I think we would probably see the biggest difference is outside of the current healthcare infrastructure. So you would see iterative improvements through tech and data in the current healthcare industry, as we see today, like what you said, mHealth, the kind of work that we are doing by using data to improve processes. But these are all iterative improvements. And I think that where we will see a leap in terms of tech playing a role would be in preventative care. That's further, upstream, way before even your health screening, when someone's healthy, mm-hmm. like someone like me right now, like I understand the importance of this, the importance of data, the importance of actually paying, you know, more, like spending more on health, on my body, and getting frequent blood tests done, which is a mindset that didn't exist before, I think, or doesn't even exist in the mainstream healthcare world. And Jerry can correct me if I'm wrong here. Like no doctor prescribes like 3-4 blood tests a year for your lipid profile, for your you know, your vitamin D levels, etc. But I do that right now with a doctor, and her role, and she's one of few, and you see many of these doctors, preventative doctors, who are bringing the nutrition, who are bringing the idea that you look at your biological parameters,
yeah,
and then you address them early, you intervene early with a lifestyle, with diet, with supplements, herbs.
Yeah.
So it's a combination of Eastern and Western medicine, and you address them way before it becomes a problem. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where you're going to see a lot of innovation.
Yeah.
You know, changes in terms of health education and changes in terms of how that's going to be delivered. I see a big like revolution coming there.
Yeah, I think, yeah, there's a lot of emphasis now in public health to target preventative health rather than curative health, because they feel like there's going to be a greater difference to health outcomes for a population, and maybe even in the long term cheaper, because curative medicine can be quite expensive. And a lot of this is focusing on, as you mentioned, like upstream determinants of health. And even within upstream, you can also break that down, right? You can break it down to like commercial determinants, political determinants, or the power structures above that sort of determine what the narrative of health should be, either consciously or unconsciously. And we as individuals are at the mercy of that sometimes. Which is why it's important that we're doing podcasts like that, right? To really inform people. I do also have to say, though, that I am also quite wary of the repercussions, because people have already spoken about over-medicalizing society, right? So when you over-medicalizing society technically means that things that are sometimes just, you know, we don't really, you know, always, you know, focus over regarding health issues, suddenly become major priorities in our thought process, and we can't like think anything but about this health issue, and so we become a bit paranoid. Over-medicalizing also has a strong attachment to the healthcare sector. So if there's a medical or if there's a health problem, only the medical sector can tackle that. You know, it disempowers people, essentially. It disempowers people, and it also encourages a potentially unhealthy reliance on an external institution or an organization. It could be, it doesn't necessarily have to be the formal medical institution that we know. It could also be in the sense of like traditional medicine. It's just a disempowering phenomenon that happens. So I think it's important to encourage preventative medicine, but in a way that empowers people to take control of their health as well, to make appropriate and healthy decisions when they go out to the shops and they choose food. They know what's healthy and what's not healthy.
You know what's interesting?
Sorry, yeah.
Just an extension of what it's sharing here, right? About making choices and political determinants. In Singapore this year, last year, the government had rolled out a sugar tax.
Yeah.
So essentially, all the sugary beverage providers.
We can't name them.
Had the choice between increase. I can't name them. No. You know, but there's that's an amazing beverage that ends with ILO, and I love it. But it was, you know, they essentially halved the amount of sugar in it because they were faced with either increasing the price by 30% or 40%, or just halving the amount of sugar, and they went with the latter, right? And I have to say, like, it's pretty impressive what the government here is doing. And ideally, I would love to speak to one of the policymakers about, you know, how they actually went about making this decision, because it's typically in Singapore, like, when decisions are made, they are very sensitive towards, like, you know, the industry players, the economic output, like affecting sales, etc. And they actually went with something here that was in direct loggerheads with, you know, consumer spend, which could essentially reduce the spend in that sector, right? And so the fact that the government pushed through and implemented it was pretty amazing, because right now, you know, a lot of the sugary beverage providers have chosen to just cut the amount of sugar in the drinks. And so as a consumer, you don't really have to make a choice anymore. The choice is made for you.
Yes, that's powerful.
This trend is generally moving in the right direction. You know, people are taking a little more control of their health, I think, over the last, when you say 10, 20 years. I think one of the key things is that healthcare information is more widely available.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And people are taking it into their own hands. But to do something like what Krish was suggesting, where, you know, you take regular blood tests and monitor your health, that can get very expensive. And I think there the incentives are very interesting. Actually, the doctors are incentivized to just spam you with lab tests, because usually the hospital or sometimes the clinic also will get a small cut off the lab test itself. So they have no issue prescribing the lab test. But what has happened, however, is the insurance companies are not willing to pay for preventative health, because preventative health, by definition, is not really an insurance problem unless you look at very long time frames. On a, say, yearly basis, you have to keep doing these things on a regular basis. It's going to cost you no matter what. And the
Hey, I've got a story here. Can I share the story?
Yeah, go ahead.
So last year, I ran into pretty much like digestive problems. Like I had, my stomach was just upset continuously. It was hard for me to like, you know, focus at work. It was affecting my mood. It started from like October of 2019. I had some pain in the lower bottom part of my stomach. And then I was monitoring. I was a bit, I was you know, aware. I was acute to the symptoms. And so essentially, in February, it started to flare up, and I was like, okay, you know, better to be safe than sorry. So I started, you know, I approached my family doctor, and he suggested I start with medication. And the thing is, I read up a little before I went in. Thank God, that's what I usually do. The immediate thing that they treat you for is IBS, and it's one of those things where, like, you know, it's like a spray and pray kind of thing. It's like, we think you
have irritable bowel syndrome, just to clarify. Yeah.
And I looked at the medication that was provided to me. I was like, no, I'm not going to take this because it's a slippery slope. And so then I insisted that I want you know, a diagnostic test done. We went to see I went to get an endo and a gastroscope done. And what happened was, the whole thing costed me about $7,000 overall. It's covered by my insurance, right? But the conclusion of it was, you have IBS, you have you know, acidic stomach. Is that right, Jenny?
Like, well, I just wanted to clarify here. When you say IBS, there's two things you can think about. Are you talking about irritable bowel syndrome, or are you talking about inflammatory bowel syndrome?
I was just told IBS.
It's an inflammatory bowel syndrome. It's very different from irritable. Irritable is usually a diagnosis of exclusion. So you've actually investigated everything as much as you can, and you can't come up with a diagnosis. And so you say IBS, irritable bowel syndrome. So people experience like bloating. You know, they feel like they haven't completely defecated. They feel like they still have a sense of wanting to go to the toilet still. Very gassy. Inflammatory bowel syndrome, on the other hand, there's two types. I don't want to go into the diagnosis, but, like, you know, these people can, a lot of them can lose weight, have bloody diarrhea. So I think they might have thought you had irritable bowel syndrome.
Irritable, for sure. Yeah, I didn't have the symptoms that you're talking about when it comes to inflammatory bowel syndrome. So And then finally, my gastroenterologist, is that right? Mm-hmm. He essentially said that, yeah, okay, you've got an IBS, irritable bowel syndrome. You know, you also got an acidic stomach. And so he just gave me a whole bunch of medication. And I looked at it. I was like, again, I'm back to the probably the same set of medication my primary care physician had given. And in addition to that, a whole suite of other set of medications. I was like, okay, I'm not going to take any of this. I need a more sustainable solution. And so then I decided to approach my doctor right now, who I go to like for any form of like preventative care. It took me like 3 or 4 months to actually see her. Like, her wait list was just crazy. And she did a full, like, more of like test that is not prescribed by any of the other doctors. So she did a microbiome test. She did a blood profile test that my other doctors didn't do. And none of this were paid for by my insurance, but the whole treatment cost came up to about $1,008. And her solution to it was eat a lot more asparagus, a lot of slimy food, so that I line the walls of my intestine and my stomach better. And so aloe vera, you know, asparagus. And then she asked me to eat more of my own food, you know, from my athletic food, which is like dosa, fermented food, reduce the amount of inflammatory food like dairy, sugar. And right now, like after like 6 months, I'm back to normal, perfectly fine. You know, but the thing is, back to Nishant's point, the insurance providers were happy to pay $7,600, but they weren't willing to pay $1,800 to solve this problem for me. So if I had gone down the insurance route, I would have been racking up more medical bills, right? Because I don't think the problem would be solved. And here I pay $1,800 and I'm back to normal with just lifestyle changes.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's one of those weird cases of misaligned incentives. I think the only solution here is for us as potential patients to get out of this mindset of health expenditure tied to insurance. I think especially in insured markets, I see huge reluctance generally. I mean, sure, there's some exceptions with certain cosmetic surgeries, etc., but generally if it's not paid by insurance, there's a huge reluctance to actually do it. But in a lot of cases, if you get out of the system and actually work on improving health versus interventionist care, it leads to a better outcome. I think this is one of those topics I hope to discuss and dig into a little bit more, into how to change the mindset. I don't think you can change the insurance company's mindset, but I think we can slowly change our mindset as consumers of health, if you will.
Yeah, I must add here that it's very important not to sort of define what we think about the traditional medical sector within which I work according to how medical insurances choose to cover, right? So if it so happens that medical insurances choose to cover the traditional medical sector and not maybe alternative ones, it doesn't necessarily mean that one is better than the other, or there's some sort of, maybe subtle unconscious power play.
Yeah, for sure not. Yeah.
Yeah. Because also, like, if you look at insurances and how they go about structuring their packages, they've got a set structure of diseases and, you know, blood tests and radiology that they would cover. And unfortunately, you know, if it's not something that they can, I guess one aspect of it is like if they can't see like extensive research done in terms of outcomes, not that it doesn't work, but it's just not enough research done. For example, I think they would be hesitant to fund that also or pay for it.
Yeah, but this is interesting, right? So like I see what you mean. And like, look, there is a place for interventionalist treatment providers. And I think there should be a place for preventative providers as well. The problem is it's very skewed towards the former right now. And I see this on two levels. One is I agree with you that, you know, the insurance providers, you know, they're just optimizing their workflow. They have a role to play, suppress the price, make sure that, you know, they act as a counter force in terms of as an economic agent, so that, you know, if you just let it to the market forces, healthcare prices just shoot up. And so they have a role to play. They're playing that role. But I think given the fact that a lot of research these days, or well, up until now, has been primarily around interventionalist drugs and less so on lifestyle. Like, you know, it's been funded a lot by pharma companies. And so that level of research around like diet, around supplements is far and few. You know, I think Dr. Walter Longo's research is now taking more prominence, the things around plastic mimic diet. And as a result, you're starting to see more and more of such clinically proven, you know, solutions for like lifestyle diet-based treatments. But that's the thing, because of the fact that there's very few research around, like, say, how supplements can help with treating, you know, lifestyle diseases down the road, someone who's in the preventative side of things, you know, is kind of handicapped. And also the insurance providers are perpetuating or not giving room for innovation to take place. I can also understand where they're coming from, because up until now, the incentive has been for healthcare providers to push supplements, because it's for the longest period, even like the industry itself, like a lot of it is sugar pills, right? And so it doesn't have much impact. But we are starting to see that change, and I'm hoping that there will be like significant changes in policies moving forward.
Yeah, I want to add here that, okay, what we're talking about is something that's highly complicated. It's about agenda setting. It's about, mm-hmm. you know, what makes it to the table of policy making based on a load of things. A politics of a country, for example, the current noise that's out there in, you know, in the public. What are people talking about? You know, what is a major issue in society? And in the past, like, I mean, these sort of preventative stuff wasn't something that, you know, people vocalized. And even if they did vocalize it, it's a very completely different society now with technology and Twitter and all of that. One small thing that you say can be circulated around the world. So your voice is a lot louder. One person's voice is a lot louder than in the past. So now what's happening is that there's definitely a growing shift for people to kind of take control of their own health and find alternative means to just the traditional way that medicine works. And I do feel like, I know that you say there's not a lot of research that's being done on like alternative or more preventative stuff. The thing is that there are a lot of papers that are coming out on gut health. A lot of it's almost a trend.
Yeah. It's a trend right now. Yeah. It wasn't like a few years ago though. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I must say, and I also just want to add here, right? Like, when it comes to sort of any health related issue, there is a stepwise, and I'm telling you this from my clinical experience, right? There is a stepwise way of diagnosing someone, whether or not practitioners actually do it. And a lot of practitioners don't do it because of the burden of patients. They see that they have just no time to carry out stepwise approaches for patients because it's just sometimes not feasible. There are a couple examples of that, but they technically should be following a step right. So if you were to go inside to a medical practice and you would say, like, I got a gut problem. I'm having like very like a burny chest after I eat certain types of foods. And someone just prescribes you straight up medication without exploring further what's happening. And without even telling you alternative non-medication means, then I don't think that's appropriate, to be honest. And there's a lot of advocacy work also by doctors who are trying to push for the health system to allow them to have the time to do that also, because they want to, but they sometimes just can't. if you're stuck with having a 10-minute consultation with patients. Like in the NHS, they've got like a time frame for each patient, which is crazy, right? Mm. But it's a systems problem. They can't get through so many patients, so each person is allocated to one symptom and then 10 minutes. Like how? That's impossible, right? That doesn't make sense, right? And so, yeah. And this last thing before I finish this point is, and not negating the fact that, Chris, you experienced a change. Like you felt a lot better after eating certain types of foods. The research side of medicine, however it's funded, the research side of medicine always has to take into consideration a few things to check the robustness of research, right? Which is chance, bias, and confounding. These three things are important. So out of five people, let me give it to you in an example. You know, some people say like, hey, my auntie lived till, 100 and she smoked. And she smoked every day of her life.
And she ate meat and she drank every day.
Exactly. So they're like, then a person will say like, so why can't I continue smoking? Why can't I continue drinking? And yet you would say like, no, it's unhealthy, right? Because you're unconsciously taking into consideration that out of 100 people, it's not unreasonable to suggest that one person might experience no side effects, right? Mm-hmm. And live till the age of 100 while smoking and drinking, you know?
We need to decode that person's DNA. But yeah, go on.
So what we're speaking about is chance, right? We're talking about chance. We're talking about statistics, you know, probabilities. So it's important that before any sort of intervention comes to play. So for example, the type of intervention you experience, for it to become mainstay, for it to become something that even the medical community would incorporate into their guidelines, it would have to be unfortunately, but fortunately, backed with research, which takes time. That's why it's unfortunate, and funding, but it needs to be backed.
Actually, though, the research is out there. That's the thing. I think it's just that, and I've seen this, right? It takes time for that research to actually come down to the doctor level and it become a mainstream form of treatment. And the usual barriers are whether or not the incentives are aligned. For a lot of the doctors that I saw, prescribing a lifestyle change is not in their interest. They make the profits from the drugs. And like, look, there may be some doctors who actually eventually do it, may become the gold standard. I don't know. But based on my experience, I'm speaking purely from my experience so far.
But are you speaking private doctors? Because in public, like definitely no one's, doctors aren't incentivized. It's not like they get more money, you know, from like the drugs that they give. Like literally.
Probably. You know? Yeah.
Is more private. Yes.
This is more private, but I would also think that my dad had the same problem and my brother had the same problem as well. And they both went on the public side and they were given the same set of drugs, but I think they were the generic ones. But what I'm coming to here is that although the research is available, I was telling Nishant, I was having a very interesting conversation with our family's cardiologist. And I'm bordering on my cholesterol levels. I'm going to borderline high. And my cardiologist immediately was like, take statins. You know, it's genetic, take statins. And then I was like, whoa, that's fast. And he's like, dude, you already tried diet. Just go for this. This is senior family. You are, you have a risk profile. So dude, go for it. And then I was like, how much time do I have? And he's like, you got a few years, but it's better to start early. So I was like, okay, let me try something, the diet, etc. And I was telling him about the Prolon diet that Dr. Walter Longo has, worked on and has become well known globally, the fasting mimicking diet. And immediately I was met with skepticism. I would even say bordering on cynicism, right? Mm. And I was trying to figure out why. He doesn't know that diet can play a role. But what I realize is that he has been jaded by all the dietary you know, suggestions that have come around, like superfoods, diets, various things that can potentially have impact on your cholesterol, and they haven't worked. And eventually everyone just went to statins. And then the other thing that was interesting was that he had a friend walking by us when we were talking about this. He roped him in and he's like, you know, he just shared the quick blurb on what we're talking about. And that doctor as well, he's also a cardiologist, and he was like, yeah, you know, ultimately everyone come back to the standard gold standard workflow. The key words that we use it there were like, you know, like workflow. And it's just a standard thing they've trained, like they have resorted to, and they're just comfortable doing it. So my point here is it's going to take a lot more time before these things become accepted by interventionist doctors.
And also that there's a kind of SOP, a standard operating procedure here, where you take pills X times a day for X days, and then you watch the metric or the certain indicator go up or down. Right. And that's the setup which been kind of honed, and there are systems for it. So then naturally something like a pill has an advantage to enter the healthcare system, because it's a clear structure on how to do a trial for it, what will be accepted. So like at every stage, you get published easier, it kind of flows into the medical system easier, and then the pill is mass produced. You just trust the pharmaceutical to, you know, not mess with the drug, and then you can give it to the patient in a controlled way, and then you can test if the marker works or not. And then, you know, it's all the surrounding infrastructure. Yeah, exactly. So the workflow is super straightforward versus, oh, eat this funny.
It's convenient for the patients, right? As well. Like for my parents, mm-hmm. right? And this goes back to what you said, like, you know, I look at my parents, they would just want a pill as a solution. Like if I tell them lifestyle, diet, hey, do all this, it's just too much effort for them. And they've been just conditioned that, you know, if any problem comes, I can just pop a pill and I'll be fine. And that's their mindset.
So that's a problem of over medicalization, right? So that's medicalization. Yeah. So you think this, so when you start to believe that the solution comes from just this hospital, you know, this like medical setting. What we're actually hearing here is almost like a war of evidence in some sense, like just to put it a bit more dramatically, right? Like it's really about which field has a system that allows for the generation of evidence more efficiently. And the traditional medical sector, because it's been super, super long that it's been just building on itself and on itself, you know, and I mean, especially in the 90s, this whole push towards evidence-based medicine really sparked the systems for evidence generation to take off, and we're actually experiencing all the I guess like the we're inheriting everything from then right now. But other you know, areas of health haven't experienced that spark. It's just been in the traditional medical sector. Others haven't experienced it so much as medicine has. So I think that's why there's this sort of, when you don't experience something good in the medical sector, right, then one would question why other alternatives aren't working. And unfortunately, you know, we need more evidence, which is building up, as you said.
Yeah, awesome, guys. I that was just an amazing deep dive into like our interests and like what's to come in this podcast series. I think we should wrap it up for this episode. I am excited by the first speaker that we have lined up. You know, she's actually touched some of these topics, and so I think we'll be discussing with her the topic of like who pays. That's relevant here, based on the discussion we had here.
Hey everyone, thanks for joining us today for this episode of Beyond the Scope, and hope you enjoyed the discussion. And we'd love to hear from you so we can get better at this. You can find us at Beyond the Scope Cast on Instagram, Twitter, or your favorite podcast platform. The link is in the show notes. And do give us a rating if you enjoyed listening. Take care and stay healthy.